Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Tuesday, January 29th, 2013.
Here I am with my immigration form. It's big enough to keep me warm when the cold winds come in. So go where you will, as long as you think you can. You gotta watch out for the man. Anywhere you're going, won't you let me in? Immigration man, can I cross the line? And
the subject of border security and the treatment of immigrants, including some 11 million people who are here without documents, has returned to center stage. After being ignored for many years, except as kind of a political football. And I give credit to the Democratic leadership and to President Obama for taking on an issue that is complicated, it's difficult, and it is a very emotional political subject. That said, we've got the president in Las Vegas today giving a speech saying that he's got a plan, but he's going to keep it to himself because yesterday, in a bit of an upstaging maneuver, 8 members of the United States Senate, 4 Dems, 4 Repubs, announced that they have reached agreement on a package. So the president is going to let that percolate, try to nudge it along where he can. And it is interesting to see Republicans step up on this, because they have mainly used it as an attack dog on Democrats, and used it to whip up the far right, the white supremacist groups in this country, gun-toting Minutemen vigilante types who want to go to the border and guard it themselves. And so it's been a really dangerous kind of political matter. And the Democratic leadership is moving forward in some ways on cold and crass political calculations. And these were articulated at a news conference yesterday by John McCain of Arizona. And he didn't talk about doing the right thing, about legalizing 11 million people who are underground in this country. He talked about it purely as a political matter and a liability to the Republicans. Because Obama got 70% of the Latino vote this past November, and in states like Texas, California, New Mexico, Arizona, the white minority populations are finally recognizing the power of non-white voters. So this is going to be very interesting because there are many landmines along this frontier, if you will. And you've got Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader, who has pledged to slow walk this. And of course, it'll be used by the right wing to raise money. Their direct mail pieces are already going out with the capital A amnesty word emblazoned everywhere they can put it. And that's what this is all going to boil down to, is can Democrats fashion a comprehensive immigration package that is not labeled as amnesty by right-wing opponents? And with Mitch McConnell promising to slow walk this, because it's so important, he says, we look back just a few days to Harry Reid's cave-in on filibuster reform. How do you slow walk something in the Senate? You avoid cloture. You prevent a matter from ending debate and going to a vote. And this is just another missed opportunity of the Democrats to make a real difference while they enjoy a majority. Yesterday, we gave you a very brief report from Jason Leopold, our friend and colleague who's currently at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. He filed a dispatch that you can read at truthout.org today, which expands on the point that he made in a brief post on Facebook that I saw yesterday. He probably tweeted it, too. He's a big Twitter man. And the issue is, as you may know, the journalists and other observers watch the proceedings through double-glass windows. And they can always see the courtroom. They can't always hear it. And as Jason reported, the audio is delayed by 40 seconds. Now, to prevent a wardrobe malfunction and the exposure of a nipple on national television, the networks use a 7-second delay. So 40 seconds is pretty extreme. And on Monday in the courtroom, the censorship process began as one of the defense attorneys raised a point about what kind of evidence can be used, and in particular, the defense is arguing that the CIA's dark sites, the prisons in Poland and elsewhere, where some of these individuals were held and tortured, should be preserved like crime scenes. And at a certain point, David Nevin, who is an attorney for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, was starting to discuss the name of a motion which included the word secret. I believe it refers to secret prisons or secret black sites. And as soon as he said the word secret, a red warning light came on, it started to flash, and the sound of white noise was fed through the audio system. Moments later, the monitors inside the gallery went black. The outage lasted for 3 minutes. Leopold notes, the courtroom is visible to members of the gallery but separated by soundproof glass. Then the defense lawyer approached the bench, engaged in a discussion with the judge, and after about 3 minutes, the feed was restored. But get this. Army Colonel James Pohl, the military judge who is nominally in charge of this military commission, appeared to be upset. He said, I didn't authorize that. I didn't tell you to, you know, cut off the sound and turn on the flashing light. And so the judge said that the matters that he and Nevin had discussed did not require use of the censor button, and that since neither he nor the court security officer was responsible for triggering the disruption, he wanted to know who was. Quote, if some external body is turning the commission off under their own view of what things ought to be, with no reasonable explanation because there is no classification on it, then we're going to have a little meeting about who turns that light on or off, said Pohl. And so there is some external person with a switch. Are they at Guantanamo? If so, who do they report to? Are they off-site at the Pentagon or at CIA headquarters? Even the judge doesn't appear to know. And so the judge initially said he was going to call as a witness one of the audiovisual technicians to explain to him how the system works. But by Tuesday morning, Pohl, for whatever reason, had thought better of it and did not do so. And so this just adds a new dimension to the kangaroo court description that we have applied to these show trials at Guantanamo. And if the judge isn't in charge of his own courtroom, then we've got some serious problems with the credibility of such a tribunal. Leopold writes, by Tuesday morning, Pohl's tone dramatically changed. He said he thought about the issue overnight and decided against allowing an audiovisual expert to give testimony because he didn't know who the right person would be to testify about courtroom security. He noted, though, that only the judge has the authority to close the courtroom. Maybe he was speaking to the unseen higher power. So this is a very interesting sidebar. Leopold reports that the defendants were in the courtroom today and that one of the issues is whether they have to be there all the time. And the judge has told them that they have the right to stay in their cell if they want to. But they also have the right to be at the hearings. And then he spoke to each of the accused individuals one at a time. asked them if they understood their rights and if they had any questions. And defendant Ben Attash said, you know, we've been dealing with our attorneys for about a year and a half, and we haven't been able to build any trust with them. Our attorneys are bound, and we are bound also. There are many things that the court could do to help us, help motivate us to attend the court, but there's nothing that would motivate us to come. And Cheryl Borman, one of Ben Attash's attorneys, told the judge that she hasn't been able to send her client a letter since October of 2011. And get these restrictions. They're supposed to be representing these people. She says, in order for me to have a conversation with my client, I have to make plain arrangements 14 days in advance to come down here for a week at a time so that I can have a short conversation with Ben Attash. And then when I get down here, I'm not even permitted to bring in a list of things that I need to discuss with him, or any draft motions that I might want to review with Mr. Ben Attash, or in fact, provide him with information I think might be relevant to the next commission proceeding. It is, in fact, a show trial. In other news, the Senate, which can do business quickly when it wants to or when it wants to help a buddy, confirmed John Kerry as the next Secretary of State in a 93-4 vote today. 94-3, pardon me. Did I get that right? 94-3. Now, his confirmation hearing was a love fest last week. Hillary Clinton came and introduced him. He stepped down as chair of the committee and took the witness stand, made a statement, allowed John McCain to do some posturing and disagree with some Obama policies, and that was it. So the oversight process of the Senate when it comes to an insider like John Kerry is almost nothing. And as I've mentioned here before, there are a lot of reasons that John Kerry's not a great pick as the next Secretary of State. Of course, members of the Senate aren't interested in that, but if you are, go to Stephen Zunis' website. I'll put up a link in the show file with this podcast, and you can read the case against John Kerry. Meanwhile, his predecessor got a big send-off on 60 Minutes on Sunday evening. Hillary Clinton got to share the show with Barack Obama. And 60 Minutes devoted two segments, about two-thirds of the program, to their joint appearance. And I see this as the final installment of the the contract that began when Obama and Clinton met in Washington at Dianne Feinstein's home. She agreed to ultimately get out of the presidential primary race. And was there a deal cut at that time for her to become Secretary of State? I don't know. The official story is that it occurred in November after the election. But in any case, I see this as Obama teeing her up for a presidential campaign in 4 years, even as he denied to Steve Croft, oh, you guys, I've only been real, I only got inaugurated for my second term 4 days ago, and you guys are already talking politics. Oh, man, how rich is that? And I don't know exactly when Kerry will take over, but I have predicted, and I may be wrong, predictions are dicey, that Hillary Clinton will put her name on the approval for the Keystone XL pipeline deal with Canada. And just kind of sweep that under the oil shale rug and hope that people don't remember it in 3 or 4 years. In an in-depth interview released today at peterbcollins.com, we talked with Mel Goodman. Mel worked at the CIA for almost 20 years, taught at the War College, adjunct professor at Johns Hopkins, a very thoughtful guy. And his new book is called National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism. We had a wide-ranging discussion almost an hour long, and I invite you to listen. Mel Goodman has a lot of criticism of Obama's foreign policy, the way he has operated the intelligence community, drone strikes, domestic surveillance. It's fascinating to hear an insider like Goodman share honest criticism, the kind that doesn't occur inside the Beltway. And the main thrust of his book is about the militarization of the CIA and about the need to cut defense spending, including the boondoggle that's called missile defense, or more commonly, Star Wars. In this excerpt from our interview with Mel Goodman, he talks about John Brennan, who is Obama's candidate, the nominee, to take over at the CIA, subject to Senate confirmation.
John Brennan, to me, has always been a cheerleader for the policies of the person who he's had to report to. So when he was an executive assistant at the CIA under George Tenet, he was a cheerleader for the rendition program, he was a cheerleader for the secret prisons, and even for the torture and abuse, and he was the one the CIA permitted to go on Sunday talk shows when very few people are permitted to do that other than the director. And now I have a concern that he is so close to the president that in a sense he's too close. Is Brennan really going to be the one to tell the president that the intelligence doesn't support what he's going to do, that the intelligence doesn't support a particular policy? And he's certainly a cheerleader for the drone operations, as you say. And I think the drone operations right now are out of control. We picked up the paper this morning. The New York Times and the Washington Post talked about drones now being, it looks like they're going to be based in Niger, so we'll be able to cover northern Africa more effectively than from the drone base in Djibouti, which I think is the only African location at this point. The targeted assassinations, the idea that there's a president in the White House who's going over lists of people who the CIA would like to assassinate is just too easy, and as you say, has no transparency whatsoever, and there appears to be no legal architecture for the policy. It's just gotten too easy to conduct warfare for this administration. There have been hundreds of these drone operations, and it was Brennan who went public about a year and a half ago saying that the CIA and the military have not killed any innocent civilians. Well, no one knows that or agrees that that could possibly be true, and even the White House has backed off of that ridiculous claim. So something is going to have to be done to slow down the administration in this area, and it's certainly not going to be Brennan, who's probably going to continue to keep the CIA as the paramilitary organization that it's become.
You can hear the full interview with Mel Goodman. It's available for subscribers right now at peterbcollins.com. If you're not a subscriber, a buck will get you a 24-hour pass, $5 for a month, $50 a year. And I'm pushing your buttons right now. You're listening to my free podcast, and I need you to support my independent work by subscribing to our in-depth interviews. All the details on the homepage at peterbcollins.com. And in segment two of today's in-depth interview podcast, we talk with Leah Bolger, the president of Veterans for Peace. She served 20 years in uniform, and she has mixed feelings about the new announcement of lifting the combat ban on women that came from the Pentagon in the last few days. I think it's an important discussion and hope you'll hear it at peterbcollins.com. I'm trying to come up with the right angle on this one, but Sarah Palin is leaving her cushy $1 million-a-year job at the Fox News Channel. Now, presumably it was the choice of Chairman Roger Ailes and his mentor, Rupert Murdoch. Probably their research showed that they gotten all the mileage out of Sarah Palin's wackiness that they could. And as they shut up the people like Sean Hannity, Karl Rove, and Dick Morris, who were so wrong about reading the electorate in 2012, they're trying to reboot, and so they booted Sarah Palin out. I don't watch Fox much, so it won't make much of a difference to me. But she rarely made any sense. I mean, she could come up with funny lines and these zingers and sound bites, but her connection to policy is so tenuous and her knowledge so limited that they knew they had to limit her exposure, because the more you saw, the more she exposed her own ignorance. Rick Perlstein is a writer who I admire. And just to put him in a zone, he's kind of an inside Washington pro-democratic guy. And that's what drew my attention to his latest piece at RollingStone.com, entitled, How FBI Entrapment is Inventing Terrorists and Letting Bad Guys Off the Hook. And he takes a look at two recent incidents in Cleveland, Ohio, during an Occupy encampment. Suspicious males with walkie-talkies around their necks and scarves or towels around their heads were heard grumbling at the protesters' unwillingness to act violently. At meetings a few months later, one of them, a 26-year-old with a black mohawk, explained to his anarchist colleagues how you can make plastic explosives with bleach. And the group of five men fantasized about what they might blow up. The man's handle, Psycho, C-Y-C-O. He suggested a small bridge. One of the others thought they'd have a better chance of not hurting people if they blew up a cargo ship. A third argued for a big bridge. So he led them to a connection who sold them C4 explosives for $450. Then the night before the May Day Occupy protests, they put a plan into motion, and just as the would-be terrorists fiddled with the detonator they hoped that would blow up a scenic bridge on Ohio's Cuyahoga Valley National Park, the FBI swooped in to arrest them. Or how about this case in rural Florida? Another arrest that occurred almost exactly the same time. On April 28th, members of the American Front, a white supremacist group labeled a known terrorist organization, in the affidavit justifying the arrest, took a break from training with machine guns for a race war in order to fashion weapons out of fake Occupy signs that they planned to use to assault May Day protesters in Melbourne, Florida. No script, no choreography, no melodramatic press conference with a U.S. attorney and FBI special agent in charge. This arrest went down only after an informant working with state law enforcement fled in fear for his or her life, after being threatened by the group's leader, Marcus Faela, with a 9mm pistol. And the media reported that this was a joint terrorism task force of FBI and local law enforcement. This is the kind of entrapment, the kind of manipulation and insertion of provocateurs that is grossly illegal, flatly unconstitutional, and we thought it last happened during J. Edgar Hoover's reign as the FBI chief. But it's happening on a widespread basis. And when you see a story that says domestic terrorism, look for the paid FBI informant, the one who put these often innocent or, I don't know, easily manipulated people up to it. Because that is a distinct pattern. And Truth Out is reporting today, in an article picked up from Alternet, that there is a spate of new laws being promoted by ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, that are nicknamed ag-gag laws. Six states have them: New Hampshire, Wyoming, Nebraska, North Dakota, Montana, and Kansas. It is a crime for a journalist or a reporter or other individual to report on wrongdoing in agriculture. You know, like animal cruelty, dangerous animal handling practices that might lead to food safety issues, or blatant disregard for environmental laws. So here's an example from Wyoming. The ag-gag bill was introduced weeks after nine factory workers in Wheatland, Wyoming, at Wyoming Premium Farms, a supplier to Tyson Foods, were charged with animal cruelty following an undercover investigation by the Humane Society of the United States. Humane Society activists videotaped workers kicking live piglets, swinging them by their hind legs, beating and kicking mother pigs. Charges were filed. And just weeks later, State Representative Sue Wallace and State Senator Ogden Driscoll introduced Wyoming's ag-gag bill, which makes it a criminal act to carry out investigations like the one that exposed the conditions at Wyoming Premium Farms. And many of the legislators involved in ramming through state ag gag bills have ties to ALEC. In Missouri, it's Representative Casey Guernsey, whose top donor in 2010 was Smithfield Foods. And it had been exposed after an undercover investigation that showed widespread abuse of pigs. And ALEC's interest in factory farm operations also is connected to one of its staunchest members, Koch Industries. After they were exposed for running one of the large cattle feeding operations that neighbors opposed, they wrote and passed the Right to Farm Act. So watch out for an ag gag bill coming to a state legislature near you. I started this yesterday, so I suppose I'll continue a little bit of coverage of the Bubba the Love Sponge libel trial in Florida. Remember, Bubba's real name is Todd Klemm, and his former radio competitor and the target of his scurrilous statements is a guy named Todd Schnitt, who was known on the air as M.J. Kelly. Yesterday, we reported that Schnitt's attorney ended up with a DUI after having drinks with a paralegal described as young and cute working for the other side. And both sides asked for mistrial declarations, but the judge said no, but threw out 5 of the 16 defamation counts against Bubba the Love Sponge. One in which Bubba accused the other guy of engaging in plugola, 3 in which he called him a fraud, and another in which he called him a snitch. 11 counts remain. And one of the reasons that Bubba's lawyers say it is okay for him to call Schnitt's wife a whore is that a former producer for Schnitt took the stand. He now works for Bubba. And testified that Schnitt spoke on the air jokingly about his wife's tattoo, calling it a tramp stamp. So the defense is trying to get the jury to think about, well, if this guy called his own wife a tramp, then can't Bubba call her a whore? This is so disgusting. It makes me embarrassed to have worked in the radio industry. But as long as I get information on the trial, I'll keep it coming, and we'll see who prevails in this mudfest, which Todd is going to come out on top. And finally today, a note for our listeners on the East Coast, and in particular in New York City. In October, we interviewed Steve Vittoria, the producer of a powerful film about Mumia Abu-Jamal. It's called Long Distance Revolutionary. And it's not about his own case of whether he killed Officer Faulkner or not. No, it is about the life and work of Mumia Abu-Jamal. And it is fascinating. And it taught me much more than I had known about the depth of his work and his determination, writing from death row for many years, unable to use a full pen. They gave him the cartridge. And so his fingers would be blistered and in great pain as he continued to express himself. And it is a really interesting film about an individual that I think most people only have a comic book notion of. So if you have a chance to see Long Distance Revolutionary on a big screen near you, I hope you'll do so. That's my news and comment for today. This podcast is free, as always, so feel free to share it with friends, foes, anybody you like. Thank you very much.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.